into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
And get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
The News Round on Off the Ball.
With Gillette. We don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
This is News Talk.
Evening, very welcome along. Coming up tonight, we'll talk to the great Luke Jensen. He will give us the lowdown on the US Open, which is underway at Flushing Meadows. Andy Murray coming through a 4-hour, 39-minute five-setter last night, amongst other bits and bobs going on. Luke Jensen with us around 7:30. Keith Wood and Rory O'Connor are on Wednesday night rugby. We have a new Heineken Champions Cup format this year, plus Leinster against Munster on Friday evening. Kevin Doyle will be with us on the football show. And John Bruin has watched the new Spurs documentary. He's going to give us the lowdown after 9:30. 53106 is the text number. We are at Off the Ball on Twitter. Richard McCormack, hello to you.
Joe, good evening.
Good evening. Ronan Mullen, hello.
Hi, Joe.
By all accounts, Enda Call Outside has watched some of the Spurs documentary. Not as bad as the staged Jose Mourinho listening to the pundits talking leak on Twitter would suggest. Better than that, apparently. We get some nice eavesdropping on a one-on-one meeting with Jose and Dele Alli. We get to watch a bit of training. We get to see Pochettino packing up his things. There's a reasonable amount of access. I'll see if John Bruin agrees, but not as terrible, Ronan, as that initial clip suggests.
I think it's streets better than the Man City one last year. I don't know what your opinion on that is, Joe, but the access we get is a few levels up, in my opinion. And Mourinho is just the perfect casting for this. I'm not sure Pochettino would have lent into it quite as well as Jose has. And I'm not quite on the Damien Delaney level of Jose Mourinho fandom. If he's the president of the fan club, I'm probably like treasurer or something. But I am a big Jose fan, and he does redeem himself a little bit. I think he's lost a bit of luster in the last decade or so, but you can see the way, you can actually get a bit of insight into how he taps into players, the likes of Dele Alli you mentioned, even Serge Aurier, who actually looks like he's on the way out at Spurs as we move into modern day. But like in the early parts of this documentary, he's sort of trying to boost his confidence a little bit as well. So no, I've been won over so far. I know they haven't dumped all the episodes in one go. I've only seen maybe the first two so far, so I wonder how the whole thing will play out.
Okay, I didn't realise you'd seen it. Well, it's two more than me. So apparently the Dele Alli stuff is quite good, where Jose Mourinho is sitting down and saying to Dele Alli, look, you were really, really good and you were really good early and something's gone wrong and only you know what's gone wrong. And apparently as well in a training session, he calls him lazy as well, says he's not working hard in training. And, you know, a big part of the opening couple of episodes is Mourinho trying to get through to Dele Alli. I mean, you couldn't say at the end of the season it's worked necessarily. I mean, I don't think Dele Alli has quite got his form of old.
No, but like you mentioned the Dele Alli thing, and it's definitely tough love. Like he calls him out in a meeting, says you're a lazy trainer, but you can influence matters on the field. And then that game, I think it was Jose's first game at West Ham, Dele Alli has this miraculous little back heel on the touchline, you might remember, when he's sort of strewn on the ground. And Mourinho basically makes a point of running over after the goal has been scored and saying, that's your goal, Dele, that's your goal. So I think that's, again, that's kind of an insight into the Mourinho, sort of his perspective on things and how he taps into players. But Aurier was almost tougher love, because before one of the Champions League games, I hope I'm not spoiling too much of this documentary for people, but he says, Aurier, you give me heart attacks at set pieces, because Aurier, as we all know, is a little bit of a liability when it comes to defending, even though that's supposed to be his prime objective. But he is inclined to give away the odd penalty. So Mourinho calls him out during the team talk. So I'm sure that was fresh in Serge's mind beforehand. So now I think the people at Amazon couldn't believe their luck, I'd say, when Jose Mourinho landed into the middle of this production.
No, it does add a lot. I mean, Kieran Dyer was talking actually on Five Live the other evening, and he was asked about it. He had watched it, and he was of a similar opinion, I think, to you, that Jose Mourinho comes out of this quite well. Now, maybe you would say, look, Spurs are in on this. They're hardly going to do a hatchet job on their manager that they've paid a lot of money for. Of course, it's going to be you know, redemptive to some degree or other. But Dyer was saying you could see the brilliance of Mourinho's man management, because Dyer was saying he looked at him at Manchester United and thought, well, he's finished. You know, whatever that mojo he had is gone. Whatever ability he had to connect with players seems to be gone. Whereas he felt, watching the Spurs documentary, you saw a bit of the magic, you saw a bit of the art of Mourinho when it comes to man management. So I'm looking forward to seeing it, actually. John Brune with us after 9:30. I don't know if you've seen it, Richie. The Man City one, I kind of gave up on that. I just didn't, keep me coming back for more. It was fine. It was a little bit wallpapery.
Like the one thing you can't expect, like, there's a line from Peep Show where they're talking about there's constantly bad news on the TV. Why don't they talk about the good news? And then David Mitchell's character goes, because it'll just be an endlessly dispassionate list of stuff that's gone on during the day and it will go on forever. And similarly, you can't really get an accurate sense of what life at a football club is like through an Amazon documentary, because rightly or wrongly, they're going to pick the stuff that looks best on camera. They're going to pick the stuff that suits their narrative best. And even if you do get glimpses of Jose's good man management at Tottenham, we're not entirely sure if that's actually the case there, because this is all done through the prism of Spurs getting the final okay on the editing, much like Jordan did with his own documentary. And they want to make sure that this is all nice and dandy and they possibly get, unlike Alan Partridge, a second series.
It's true. It's the fatal flaw of all these documentaries. So Luke Jensen coming up 7:30. Andy Murray last night. I mean, the man.
Superb.
He is just one of the greats. 33 years old. 4 hours, 39 minutes. By all accounts, I need to double check this stat. This was his first competitive five-setter in 4 years. I don't quite know how that's possible, but his first competitive five-setter in 4 years. He was two sets to love down. It was over. He was finished. And he fought back to win in five sets, 4 hours, 39 minutes. Injured his hip, Wimbledon 2017. Since then, he's played in just two Grand Slams and he hasn't made it past the second round in either. As we know, he announced his retirement in January 2019. He's since had another surgery, and so some 20 months later, he's back and he's in the second round of the US Open.
That's how that five-set stat comes to pass. It's because of the original date of that injury back in 2017, and you factor in how few Grand Slams he's actually played since then. Watching him in the first two sets last night, like I was talking about it here on the show, it was ongoing, and I was watching it afterwards after we finished up, and I was just kind of, not shaking my head, but I was getting to feel a little bit downcast about it, kind of thinking that, yeah, maybe, you know what, it's probably beyond him at this stage to go deep into a Grand Slam, even with a thinned field, and even at his age, etc. But Jesus Christ, there was some switch flicked in him, and it was the Murray of old. It was the fist pumping that we saw against Richard Gasquet at Wimbledon about 12 years ago. It was the guy who pulled an Olympic win out of the fire as well to beat Federer, and it was that little glimmer was there again with Murray. And even seeing him speak afterwards, he's made a career out of looking knackered and looking like he can't possibly win, but I am going to enjoy this latter era Andy Murray, where it's a space that Leighton Hewitt occupied a few years ago, where he's the old stager and he'll turn it to a Grand Slam and nobody really fancies him, and he's got an injury history as long as your arm, but he'll knock a five setter and a few cheers out of the crowd, albeit not one here, but he'll knock a five setter out of the park and he'll go into the last 16 quarterfinals and cause a few ructions, and everybody's just delighted to have him there. And I think Andy Murray's that kind of presence
and just incredibly likeable as well. Not exactly sure, Ronan, when we all went from thinking this guy's a bit dour to actually thinking this guy's brilliant, you know, fantastic. Everybody, I think, really likes Andy Murray now. I don't know when that happened. Certainly the last 5, 6, 7 years minimum, I think everybody's been on the Andy Murray train.
Yeah, there's an everyman nature to him, isn't there? Which seems a bit absurd to say, given how supernaturally talented he is. But compared to the likes of Federer and Nadal and Djokovic in particular, who just seem of another sphere entirely, you can kind of relate to Andy Murray a little bit more because he wears his heart on his sleeve in that fashion. And Richie mentions that Gasquet match and it's sort of imprinted on my mind. It's one of those Wimbledon nights where the light's coming down and they try to get the match finished before the end of play, and he just got the job done. It was incredible. And then it was 2012 he won the US Open, and again it was much like last night where he's sort of synonymous with Wimbledon, obviously, for obvious reasons, but that was his maiden Grand Slam. And much like last night, I just found myself coming into it late because obviously the US Open doesn't cater for audience in this part of the world quite like Wimbledon does. But I kind of landed midway through that final and it was the same last night. When he's playing in this sort of way, it's like must watch television, isn't it?
Yeah, no. Well, Luke Jensen will join us 7:30. So it kicked off in a bit of style with Murray doing that. Obviously, Serena Williams is going for her 24th Grand Slam singles title to equal Margaret Court's record. So Luke Jensen, 7:30. Keith Wood, Rory O'Connor, 8:00. And then Football Show, the Spurs documentary with John Bruin. And Kevin Doyle will join us as well. So that is us between now and 10 o'clock. We should kick off the news round with thanks to Gillette. We don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters. And the story of the day, Richie, Sam Bennett has a very nice addition to his CV.
He does indeed. He's become the first Irish rider in 31 years to claim the green jersey on the Tour de France. The Quickstep rider finished third on today's fifth stage, but he now leads the sprinter's points race from Peter Sagan. Wout van Aert took the stage win, but Adam Yates is the new man in yellow. Previous yellow jersey wearer Julian Alaphilippe surrendered the lead, pardon me, having been given a 20-second penalty. Bennett's the first Irishman since Sean Kelly in 1989 to wear that green jersey, and only the third if you include Stephen Roach.
Parochial types that we are, what exactly is the green jersey again? We were asking ourselves outside, so we did a bit of looking, and there is points classification as well. So there are points awarded for the top 15 riders in each stage, and how many stages in Sam Bennett's amassed the most points? He's had a lot of top
and there are intermediate sprints as well during the course of there's one tomorrow, and I know Bennett won one yesterday along the way too, so it's not just the finish. Along the route they kind of try and keep the sprinter's end in, just to keep them interested. So that this is essentially the table that he's topping at the moment.
Okay, so yeah, it's predominantly sprinters, I guess. It makes sense. I mean, if a yellow jersey leader can, you know, does all his work on one day in particular and then is kind of so-so for a lot of days, it's another way to reward consistently good finishes. So that's good for Sam Bennett. We'll try and chat with him in the next couple of days. Where are we going next, Rich?
The Republic of Ireland squad, they're injury-free ahead of tomorrow's Nations League game with Bulgaria. They train today in Sofia ahead of what will be Stephen Kenny's first game in charge. Shane Duffy will return to a new club following his international duties over the next 5 days. The Brighton defender has signed a one-year loan deal with Celtic, and Kenny says the move makes sense for lots of reasons.
Been a lot of interest in Shane, and rightly so. You know, such a commanding presence as a centre-back, and he's such, you know, such stature in both boxes, you know. So I think there's been a lot of interest. So that his decision has been to go to Celtic, I think. So we certainly wish him well with that.
Remember chatting to Dame Delaney about a week ago, and I was asking about the move from Duffy's perspective. So, you know, you as a centre-half, Damien, are you better off playing in the Premier League, admittedly at one of the lesser teams, but against the world's best strikers? Or are you better off going to a Celtic where you may not have to defend all that often, but you're arguably at a bigger club, whatever that means? And he was saying initially he'd been of the opinion that you're better off being in the Premier League, but he'd spoken to one or two teammates who'd been at Celtic, and they talked about the pressure that's on you and the expectation that's on you, and that expectation and that kind of pressure cooker, and, you know, if you only win 1-0, why haven't you won 4-0? That heat on you keeps you sharp and keeps you out of bad habits. So that, look, it's a great move for him. He's obviously thrilled to be going.
You get to play Europe
Celtic
as well.
Fans. Do you get? I mean,
well, depending on how they get on in the Europa League qualifiers,
you're not getting Champions League of late. That's for sure.
No, you're not. But like, European football is European football, and he's not getting that at Brighton, and he wouldn't have got that at West Ham either. So it's another thing to add to his collection, and it'll be another help to him at international level for sure.
I mean, personally, taking Damien Delaney's perspective on it, I still think you're better off staying in the Premier League and playing against the world's best strikers week in, week out. I think that would keep you sharper. I don't buy the explanation that Damien had been given by a couple of Celtic players. I think, why wouldn't you want to play against the very best strikers in the world week in, week out?
The thing is, though, is he? Like, he would have been...
Oh, sorry, if he's not starting. No. If he's not starting, But
he would have been third or fourth choice centre-back at Brighton still if he stayed there. At West Ham, yes, I'm guessing he probably would have been the starting 11, but I don't think deep into the season it would have been guaranteed either. So I think at Celtic, he is probably the star man in their defence. I think they're going to have one or two departures based on what Neil Lennon said over the past fortnight coming up shortly. So he'll fit right in there, and he'll be the guy, from a local point of view over in Glasgow, it always seems to help when there's an Irishman in the centre of the team too.
Oh yeah, you can see the move really working out for him, to be fair. John says, lads, tennis might not be a contact sport. The physical demands, though, over several hours, usually in boiling heat, make it one of the tougher sports out there. I can't remember too many sports where you see athletes getting sick at the side of the court through sheer exhaustion. Yeah, it is.
Speed walking, Joe.
Tough speed walking.
The stuff I've seen, Joe.
4 hours, 39 minutes yesterday. I mean,
yeah, that's it's sapping heat in New York.
You played a round of golf for 4 hours, 39 minutes, you'd be wrecked. Can't imagine tennis.
It's not really sustainable for Andy going forward, I don't think. He might have to lean more on the serve and volley side of things, nice short and sharp games rather than these long marathon matches that he's famous for. But given the way his body is at the moment, 33 years old as well, that I don't think he'd be playing too many 4 hours plus matches going forward.
He said afterwards his big toes were in a lot of pain.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been used to that kind of movement. Like, you talked about it yourself, he hasn't done a five-setter at a Grand Slam in 4 years. And that's a lot of lateral movement, and it's a lot of movement that, as much practice as you might rack up on the practice courts, you just can't replicate that in a five-setter in the Arthur Ashe Stadium. So, like, I've no doubt that probably with a new pair of runners and a new pair of everything else and a different opponent in Nishioka that he hadn't faced before, like, it's going to take it out of him.
I'd say he woke up stiff this morning. I'd say he was sore. Quick quiz, boys. Name me two Bulgarian footballers not named Stoichkov, Petrov or Lechkov, says Barry and Meath.
There was Peter Mikarski, who was the only member of the 94 World Cup squad whose name didn't end in a V. I think he went on to play for Aberdeen. And Lubo Penev, who played, I think he's in that squad and he played for Valencia as well.
Take that, Barry and Meath. Take that.
Krasimir Balakov, who was in the team of the tournament in 94 as well.
Connor reckons any Fly in the Wall documentary gets my vote. Even the bad ones usually worth a watch. I mean, there is even the Man City one, which wasn't great, threw in lots of little things you just couldn't know otherwise. Like, you couldn't quite know what Benjamin Mendy is like, you know, this guy, mad, larger than life personality. And even someone like Fabian Delph, you would never know he's such a leader. Like, you would never have looked at Man City at the outside and said, well, Fabian Delph is one of the most important voices in that dressing room. Like, you just, and yet he was. And for moments like when Pep is screaming at them, you know, I don't care if you hate me. I don't care if you hate me. That kind of stuff is probably worth giving them all the a watch, to be fair.
The thing about it is, pre-PR teams, these things were an absolute gem. There's a Man City one that's on YouTube that involves Malcolm Allison being at the club and then leaving. I think John Bond comes in. That one's fantastic. Neil Warnock, during his time at Sheffield United, that documentary is special as well. And there's another, oh yeah, how could I forget? The Rod Squad. John Courtney passed away there recently. Was chairman of Carlisle, obviously, when Roddy was over at Carlisle. Like, that is completely unfiltered and just fantastic for it. But there are all kinds of filters for this Man City one and this Spurs one.
Yeah, it's just the way of the world. They'll just be manhandled and PR'd within an inch of their life. Obviously, the infamous one with Graham Taylor when they failed to qualify for the World Cup. You know, that's
a work of art.
It's extraordinary that they got that, you know, at that level. You know, they got that one over the line. That'll never be repeated again. Where are we going next?
Another Irishman on the move today. Championship newcomers Wickham have signed Republic of Ireland winger Daryl Horgan. The former Dundalk man has spent the past two seasons with the Scottish side Hibs. Another transfer today of note: Manchester United have completed the signing of Ajax midfielder Donny van de Beek. The 23-year-old has cost €44 million. Van de Beek signed a four-year contract at Old Trafford with the option of a fifth.
So a new format next year in the Heineken Champions Cup.
Yeah, to keep a lot of people happy, Connacht will play in next season's Heineken Champions Cup after the tournament organisers confirmed 24 teams will take part in the competition. The tournament will consist of 8 teams from the Pro 14, 8 from the top couturiers in France and 8 from the English Premiership. The competition will start in December with 2 pools of 12, with teams ranked into 4 tiers. Connacht will be among the Tier 4 sides. Each team will play 4 pool matches and the quarterfinal stages will be over 2 legs, with a decider to be played in Marseille next May.
Yeah, so over 8 weekends, that's how the competition will run off. Quarterfinals over 2 legs, Ronan. I must say I'm very intrigued with that. I'd much prefer the extra games being in knockout stages than in the group stages, where there's now only 4 games as opposed to the usual 6. Like, for instance, Leinster Saracens. I would, you know, that home and away, sign me up, no problem.
So that's an aggregated score, presumably, is it?
Yeah.
Rather than, yeah. So yeah, brilliant to get the best teams playing each other as much as possible. But you can't see this format being the sustainable one going forward. Like, I know in GAA circles there's talk that the current situation might pave the way for a much heralded and long awaited restructuring of things, but I think this is very much a one and done scenario for the European rugby scene, unless, like, it's a rip roaring success and those knockout stages that you mentioned are just so good that you can't turn them down. But I just think it's a little bit convoluted, the group stage. I think if group stages are any more convoluted than they already are, people are going to lose interest. So I think the more basic, the better, probably.
They are convoluted. At the risk of appearing in a Nations League-esque montage sometime soon, as I understand it. So as you said, Richie, 8 teams from the Pro 14, 8 teams from the Premiership, 8 teams from the top 14. There's our 24. That bit is simple. And then we're into 2 groups of 12. So effectively, to use, say, Leinster as an example, say they are a tier one team from the Pro 14, if they go on and win the match on Friday evening, there'll be Leinster and the winners of Ulster, Edinburgh. They'll be the two tier one teams in the Pro 14, naturally enough, as the two finalists. So in effect, if you're in tier one, you're playing all the fourth tier teams and your route is much easier. So Leinster, if they were tier one, would play the fourth tier team from the French League, the fourth tier team from the Premiership, and a fourth tier team from the Pro 14, albeit not an Irish team. There's no domestic matches in the group stages. So they'd have a fourth tier team from each of the three leagues, and that would probably be them nicely through to the quarterfinals. That's not that convoluted. And then tier two and tier three teams play against each other as well. So four against one, so weaker sides against the top sides. They'll be blowouts most likely, I suppose. And then that's maybe the inherent weakness of the thing. And then maybe the tier two teams against the tier three teams in the group stages will be the more exciting games and the more evenly matched games in some respects. But it should guarantee you get all the top teams through to the knockout stages, and then you have doubleheader quarterfinals. So I'm more than willing to give this a chance. Have I made sense there, or did you nod off?
No, I think I got it.
Richie's trying to think of other Bulgarian footballers.
I was trying to think of a bed that I go along with that.
Just the sound of snoring actually could work with me talking, or you know, some kind of lullaby.
Oh, that's it. I've actually thought of what I've got to do with it. That'll be done by the end of the night.
A lullaby sound with me talking about the Champions Cup. There you go. Done. So look, the short version is Connacht are in the Champions Cup next year. Now, where are we going next? Oh, fans we'll back at games? Fans back
Seems
at games?
So, yeah. The English RFU hoping to have 20,000 fans attend England's international against the Babas at Twickenham next month. The RFU plans to use a quarter of the stadium's full capacity with space allowed for social distancing. The match takes place on October 25th, a week before England play Italy in their rearranged Six Nations fixture.
We are going to struggle increasingly. I mean, social solidarity is probably creaking as we speak in the country, but certainly from next month, when you have the likes of, you know, decent numbers, 20,000 at Twickenham, and obviously in Scottish rugby they're bringing numbers back, the notion that we're going to have sport totally behind closed doors here, GAA, will come under even more scrutiny. Now, Ronan Glynn has made the point, it's not so much being at the stadium that's the issue, it's everything that goes with getting to the stadium, seeing your neighbours outside the stadium, that is the mixing of households that they don't want. But I would think next month, I mean, when there's 20,000 at Twickenham, it's going to be hard for everybody to kind of say we're just going to keep the GAA totally behind closed doors.
With that said, though, I don't think we necessarily want to follow the exact lead of the English government.
They've done very well out there, no?
Not really. And factor into that as well. Like you mentioned, the social aspect around the games. Like you figure, how are, you know, 20,000 people going to get to Twickenham?
Yeah.
Most of them are going to get there by tube. And you think of even the 20,000 crowd going by tube to Twickenham. Like, it's not a place you want to be in the middle of a pandemic, with all due respect.
You think the 20,000 rugby fans going to Twickenham will be taking the tube? Richie, they've never been on the tube.
Listen, Joe, the tube is a fantastic resource by lots.
Not by the Twickenham set.
Well, look at Scotland last week. They're probably going the better way around it there. Like, Edinburgh isn't the most populous of stadiums for a Pro 14 and a game anyway. But they had 700, I think it was, in and around for Edinburgh Glasgow last Friday. They're probably going to start tinkering with those numbers, but it's still going to be relatively small. I think they've started off small as well in France, and it's probably the way to go. Almost going full bore and going 20,000 at a rugby international seems somewhat reckless. And I think there'll be lessons to be learned from it.
It's a lot. And I was joking about the chew point before somebody texts in and takes that too. Literally,
it's a class war, Joe.
20,000 is a fair old heap, though. I mean, as you said, congregating in and around the stadiums. And like, even with the GAA fixtures here, I'm not sure how we get away from people socialising. You know, if you let 200 in, 400 in, 500, 600 in, and they're all socially distant. I mean, Ronan, I mean, you think of human nature. If you're walking out and your neighbour's walking out, yeah, you're just going to fall into conversation. You're going to be over to see each other, and you know the mixing of households is going to happen. It's inevitable.
Yeah, totally. And I think if proper precautions are abided by within the game itself and around the game itself, beyond that, there's not much you can do to control people's activity anyway. Like, regardless of whether it's around a sporting event or not, what people do in their own free time is inevitably, you know, it's going to fall on their own shoulders regardless. So I think if we, like, it's difficult not to be proactive on the point you guys are making there, that when you see what's happening across the water and 20,000 people, that the limits over here probably aren't consistent with that or sustainable in relation to it. So I think it's inevitable, really, that the crowds are going to start coming back. Whether they're going to come back to that extent, yeah, it remains to be seen. But I think it's only a matter of time.
You suspect, actually, to be fair, probably with schools coming back this week, maybe there was a degree of, right, let's just shut down as many things as we can and let's see how the schools thing goes for a week or two or three and see where we are. You kind of think that's where the thinking is at the moment. US Open then anyway, Richie, sorry. So Andy Murray aside.
Yeah. Andy Murray aside, men's top seed Novak Djokovic in second round action later. He faces England's Kyle Edmund. Women's top seed Karolina Pliskova faces Caroline Garcia in the last match scheduled for the Arthur Ashe courts tonight. 2018 champion Naomi Osaka, she plays the world number 74 Camilla Giorgi. 2016 winner Angelique Kerber through to round three following a straight sets win over her fellow German Anna-Lena Friedsam. Also through is Petra Martic, who beat Katerina Bondarenko in straight sets. Another Ukrainian, pardon me, has fallen to a seed this evening. The sixth seed Petra Kvitova, a former two-time Wimbledon champion, has beat Karolina Kozlova in straight sets 7-6, 6-2. Last night, as you mentioned, Murray came from two sets and match point down to Yoshihito Nishioka to win in five sets. It took 4 hours, 39 minutes for Murray to earn a second round spot in what was his first Grand Slam match in 20 months, and he was delighted to get through in the circumstances.
I'd got the balance like completely wrong. Like at the beginning, I was not doing enough with the ball, and then he was dictating the points, and then I started being too aggressive and going for too much and making mistakes, and then finally started to get, I guess, a little bit the balance right of what I had to do on the court, and actually finished, like, wasn't playing really well all of the time, but at moments I was starting to hit the ball better, serving better, moving forward a bit more at the right times, because I was moving forward in the second set, third set, but, you know, probably at the wrong moments. And, just got that balance right at the end. And, yeah, it was a pretty special one to get through, really, because I didn't play my best. No one there watching. Long match, five set, or first one I played in a long time. So it's a great effort to get through.
He's wrecked. Before we wrap up, we should mention this Stephen Hendry story.
Yeah, the seven-time world champion has come out of retirement. The Scot, who quit the sport in 2012 and has been a commentator since, will return to the main circuit for the next two seasons. Hendry claimed his first world crown in 1919. He went on to win the Crucible's top prize six more times within the decade. Hendry is back.
Amazing. I mean, he went off the boil so quickly and disappeared so quickly. What age is he now?
He'd be deep into his 40s now at this stage. I think he's 45-ish. Yeah. Maybe older, yeah.
Okay. We'll try and catch up with him. He did a great interview with Donald McRae not so long ago talking about his sudden decline. It was very sudden, so that's interesting. He's back. 51, I'm hearing. 51.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
51.
Like, when everyone else was criticising Ronnie O'Sullivan's comments about the next generation, Stephen Hendry was notably agreeing with him, so he probably thought, you know what, Ronnie's right. These lads aren't great. I'm going to come back and wipe the floor with them. But, yeah, you're right. Because, like, he won all his world championships in the 90s, I'm fairly sure. So yeah, when I started watching snooker, it came into my consciousness, he wasn't that great. Like, he was never really competing for the top prizes. So, as you mentioned, he went off the boil. So I wonder, to what extent is he just coming back to scratch an itch, or does he actually have designs on winning more silverware? So, yeah, I think it's another boost for snooker, which seems to have come back to the forefront a little bit in the last few weeks.
Stephen Hendry, Ronnie O'Sullivan in the 2021 final is one I think we would all watch.
I can't remember who was talking about it during the World Championships, but they were saying the way that Hendry still talks about the game, and even the way that I think he did a couple of practice frames backstage at the Crucible, he still very much has that grit about him that he wants to do something. And I think he could be a danger to the younger folk playing on the circuit at the minute.
Okay. Very interesting. Richard McCormack, thank you. Ronan Mullen, thank you. We are talking US Open with Luke Jensen in just a moment.
The News Rant on Off the Ball.
With Gillette. We don't just play the game, we change it. Gillette, made of what matters.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.